Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.
We move on to the second half of Darren, Donick, and Chase here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Coming up at the bottom of the hour, Tom Glavine, longtime Braves left-hander, stint with the Mets, Hall of Famer, 300-game winner, baseball analyst for the Braves now on Fox Sports South. So we're looking forward to that conversation. We are efforting right now to try to hook up with Reese Davis. He's scheduled to join us right now on the show, so we're looking forward to that. Keep our fingers crossed. In the meantime, we await news to come down on perhaps an NHL agreement and, you know, maybe soon. It's been speculated that they will not only announce the official return to play and officially the hub cities of Edmonton and Toronto, but also a new labor extension of the CBA, which would be excellent, and even a return for the top players, the NHL players, if you will, to the Winter Olympics. That would be pretty cool. Chase, another thing, speaking of hockey, we're going to talk to Victor Arvidsson. We're going to have a conversation with him at 1 o'clock as well.
Yeah, it was a cool thing that we did yesterday with our staff. Got to be on a Zoom call, and Pete Weber conducted the interview with Victor Arvidsson, so pretty cool. We'll play that for you. Bob McKenzie did tweet this out about 9 minutes ago, though, Willie. I don't know if you saw this. With Edmonton and Toronto being chosen as the two NHL hub cities, the question most often asked now is which of the two will play host to the Stanley Cup final and the conference finals. The answer is apparently Edmonton. McKenzie goes on to say, I'm guessing the rationale for that decision is simply based on public health safety numbers. Whatever the reason, Edmonton it will be. So it sounds like the Cup, because I was wondering that too, that they were going to have the two hub cities, but eventually you have to have conference finals and come together for the Cup final. And so it looks like they are going to move everything to Edmonton once they get to that point.
Wow. You know, I actually had not thought that far ahead of which one would be the one, you know, once you got down to the Final Four. But that's a – I mean, think about that. Edmonton will be the center of the hockey universe.
Right. Yeah. And that's – I think that that's not a bad plan just because – you know, you think of Toronto. Toronto, obviously, a bigger city. And as they said, with the numbers and all of that, Edmonton is going to make more sense.
Wow. And we had Mark Spector on earlier in the show kind of laying out what it would look like in Edmonton, how they're going to put it together. The case numbers are very low there, which has been very, very important. It was funny. When we had Mark on, he referred to 40-degree days in Vegas. And, of course, he was talking Celsius. So
right, I know
you
that
might have raised your eyebrows people. If you were listening to the interview going, what is he talking about? But 40 degrees would be like the 100 degrees in that you would be used to talking about the heat in Vegas. But he kind of said that he was not surprised that Vegas, they moved away from that just because it's conducive. The environment there is conducive to people getting together, hanging out, you know, free of inhibition, and that doesn't spell good numbers for keeping, you know, the case level down. So he wasn't surprised at all that they moved into Canada, where they've kept the numbers low. It's not as high a populated area to begin with. So it's maybe easier to foresee that they can keep those numbers down. So it makes sense from that standpoint. But that is interesting that Edmonton got the nod over Toronto, if that's what ends up happening.
Yeah, yeah. So, again, as I have said on this, and I know you agree with this, nothing's official, and until Gary Bettman tells me what's happening, I'm just going to report what I see or hear or read and just kind of move on from there. But you got to go with whatever Gary Bettman puts out there whenever they come up with this and agree to it. But everything is consistent that it's Edmonton and Toronto, and now Bob McKenzie, who has been all over this, by the way, because one thing to consider, we talked to Mark Spector, you know, Elliot Friedman usually joins us at 1 o'clock on Thursday. He's on vacation. I mean, this is that time of year where the hockey writers get their vacation time, but Bob McKenzie has been all over this to try and give us the latest of what's going on. But I believe now we have Reese Davis.
Outstanding. All right, let's not waste any time. Reese Davis from ESPN is with us. And Reese, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm happy to be with you guys. Thanks for having me.
Well, Reese, as you can imagine, in Nashville, you know, SEC country every day, I know there are a lot of people, you know, watching and hoping, and, you know, we've been getting through this for a long time, hoping for college football. But, of course, as we know, in our area, there's been plenty of rise in the case numbers. And I think we've twisted around, you know, at different months, at different stages. Some days I convince myself you're on track and everything should be fine. And then other days I think, how can you possibly think you're going to play? It's a weird thing that we're all going through. So I know you were talking on ESPN here recently about some of the things you've been discussing. So what's the temperature in your mind right now?
I think I talked to several people across a few different conferences within the last several days, and I thought that the phrase that stuck with me that I thought best describes most people's feelings is bruised optimism, meaning that there's still hopeful and there's still optimism that we can play the season in some form. You know, I don't anticipate at all, you know, playing normally, meaning, you know, full crowds or even big crowds. I don't anticipate that being a reality. Certainly we all hope so. I think we all wake up every morning hoping for a big news flash that they found the vaccine and it's, you know, been fast-tracked through clinical trials and it'll be ready on Thursday, you know, stuff like that. But, you know, that's kind of a dream world, I guess. But I think that, and I apologize for the digression, but I think that most people are still optimistic there will be a season in some form, we'll be able to play, but it is far more, there is more skepticism mixed in and more, let's see how these cases that are rising play out. Does it put a strain on the healthcare system? Is there a spike in the death rate? All of those things that we hope and pray do not happen just for the health and safety of people. But those are things that I think that they're watching and evaluating. And obviously the entire game changer to me, because so many of the schools that have gathered and have many of their athletes back on campus have had a pretty significant number of positive tests. But everyone I've talked to, assuming that they're being truthful, you know, and I wouldn't divulge which schools, but, you know, all of them have asked to stay off the record in terms of which schools we're talking about. No one has told me they've had anyone who's gotten seriously ill, and we're thankful for that. But if that were to ever change, you know, that could really change the dynamic of the thought process of whether how feasible it is to play in this season.
Reese, would there be any point, because I think they're still holding out hope of some fans in the stands, maybe 25% or something, but as you mentioned, it's not going to be what we've come to know year after year, the great atmospheres that we always look forward to on Saturdays. Do you think the movement will come up at some point again of, hey, if we could play in the spring and have the stadiums full, if it got to that point, do you think they would be at this point in time able to make that shift, or do you just not see that in the cards? Do you think it'll just be get through the season, even if it means the stadiums are empty?
Well, I think I read Sandy Barber, I think, Penn State AD, the other day, said that looking at spring football would be a last resort. And I sort of feel that way, too, because on what would you base that? Now, if you had hardcore evidence from the medical community, vaccine is ready, but it won't be available to the public until, you know, January 4th, but it will be, and we're ready to go, then maybe. But otherwise, what are you basing that on? I mean, you're then saying second wave, you know, potentially. Do you have another outbreak? Do you not? How do you know for sure that it will be safer? So, you know, all of these things, this is completely new territory for our generation. You know, I hear people say unprecedented all the time, but I would imagine if we could talk to the people who lived through the Spanish flu, that they might beg to differ. But, you know, it's certainly for our generation, this is something we have not experienced. It's a disease that that medical community doesn't have experience with. So I don't know what you would base that on. That's been my whole thing. If you want to kick the can down the road and hope, okay. I mean, I can live with that. But, you know, this idea that we would know for sure, you know, absent some type of scientific or medical breakthrough, I don't know how you'd know for sure that you'd be ready in the spring.
You know, one thing you said that I've been thinking about, especially this week, and I'm really happy to know that, you know, knock on wood, the people that have tested positive, you know, these are healthy guys. These are big time athletes that nobody has reacted serious. I mean, with any really grave problems as of yet. And again, we keep our fingers crossed. But I have thought about the dynamic of big guys, you know, big offensive linemen who, you know, from what we read, would. You know, be more susceptible to having an adverse reaction if they got the virus, and just the repeated, you know, close quarters that you play in when you play football. I have thought about that. Once you start actually having scrimmages and games, you know, how practical that would be.
I don't know. I hear what you're saying, and there's certainly athletes who play with underlying conditions. Some are known, some are unknown, and you have to evaluate that and whether that is a prudent thing to continue or for them to do. You know, all of those things are sort of beyond my purview. And I wouldn't feel comfortable speculating about whether a lineman would be at risk or not at risk. And you know, that's why I'm always a little bit hesitant when people say we're absolutely not going to play, or we're absolutely going to play, or there will be X number of serious illnesses based on a model, because, you know, some models have been accurate for a while and then get sideways. Some have been completely inaccurate. You know, there are big, if you read all of the stuff on from all the different angles, there's a, you know, big fight about how you evaluate all of this data we're getting. And so, you know, there's so much unknown. I think it's very difficult to predict. And, you know, so I don't know the answer to that. I do know this, that because the players don't have outside representation, and, you know, the schools, the programs have pretty much said that they would give them latitude to make their own decisions and not penalize them for that. There's tremendous peer pressure to go ahead and play. I think the overwhelming majority of them want to, but even among those who might not, there would be a lot of peer pressure for them not to play. And there's no union. There's no compensation. You know, all of those things need to be taken into account. And while these young men are adults, the older adults who have more experience, more responsibility, really need to step back and not make this decision solely based on the balance sheet. Money and the economy and all of those things, the economy of college athletics, that's important. There's nothing wrong with it. There are things wrong with it, but I mean, philosophically and morally, having an economy to it, I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. I think we need to evaluate how that money is dispersed and how we need to lift the restrictions on the players from making some. But at this point, which we're on the way to doing, it looks like, but, you know, they don't have representation. They don't have protection. The UCLA players that wanted third-party oversight, I don't blame them for that. You know, all of those things have to be taken into consideration when making the final decision as to whether enough risk has been mitigated to allow college football and other sports to continue. There's nothing that's totally risk-free. Everyone understands that. And it may be, while we're all hopeful for a vaccine or a treatment, it may be that our culture has to learn to function within certain confines to mitigate as much of the risk as possible, and that it will not be scientifically possible to eliminate this risk. I hope that it will be, but we don't know the answer to that yet. So all of those things have to be, you know, taken into consideration. The decision needs to be made with a lot of prudence and deliberation and real, legitimate, not lip service concern, but legitimate concern for the group of players not compensated who need to, in many cases, probably be protected from themselves, because we all know when we were 18 to 22, we all thought that, you know, nothing could happen to us. And so, you know, you understand that feeling from those young men, but sometimes the more experienced adults in the room need to say, okay, I hear you, you may be right, and we have to evaluate whether, you know, what the real risk is.
Reese Davis is with us from ESPN, and Reese, you make some very good points right there, but one thing I wonder, we're seeing players realize that they have more of a voice than maybe they thought that they've had. We've seen change with some social injustice issues by players speaking out against their head coaches and having more of a conversation. So what is the balance of them realizing, hey, you know what, we need to have some say in this, but as you just said, having people that have been through life experiences a little bit more than them also getting in the room and having the conversation with them and them being able to work together to come up with some of these decisions?
Well, I think it's a great thing that the players have a voice. And I think, you know, the young people today are more informed. You know, there's not a, you know, I mean, I think there's still politeness and respect in terms of yes or no, sir, but there it's not disrespectful to ask why are we doing this, you know. And maybe, you know, 30, 40 years ago when we were in high school and college, no one would have dreamt of doing something like that. There's nothing wrong with that, and they should ask those questions because more inclusive answers can come out of those questions. And I'm talking, you know, in terms of evaluating whether they should play. It's going to be hard to go in and tell. They'll be disappointed, you know, to go in and tell a team, guys, you know, virus is too prevalent, we're rolling back the season, or we're you know, we're only going to play six games and play home games, you know, or, you know, only conference games, whatever it might be. It's not going to be popular because guys want to play, but I think they're also, for the most part, most of them are mature enough to understand the times in which we live and doing things for the greater good. Now, all of those things, I hope that doesn't happen. I hope that we're able to start the season on time, that we're able to play, even if we don't have crowds, that the players are able to compete safely, and we have some, you know, we have some entertainment, and they're able to, you know, pursue their college careers and go on and pursue their professional dreams if they have them. You know, all of those things we hope happen, but, you know, you just have to be very prudent. And, you know, the administrators also have to take into consideration they would be negligent and derelict in their duties if they didn't. Not only do they need to have the human compassion, but they have to take into account their liability. And that's a fact of life. They have to look at it and see whether it's wise to try to do it. And the good news is there's still a little more time to be able to gather data and make those types of decisions.
Reese, I had a conversation with one of your colleagues, Jason Fitz, a few weeks ago about this sort of thing with fans as really being the big part of it. But you're obviously a part of a show that goes on the road. You're surrounded by a ton of people every week. We all watch College Game Day. And even, you know, we've seen reports, okay, maybe they could have half capacity or maybe no fans, or we're not going to know until we actually get to that point. But from just your standpoint as a host and as somebody that, I mean, you obviously have your life to live. Have you thought about, well, what if I'm hosting game day and there are some fans around and we're still at the point where we don't have a vaccine, where, as you said, learning to live with it?
Yeah. I mean, sure. We're planning for all different contingencies, and I think we're all aware of it. And we would observe the social distancing guidelines and all the things that, you know, if it is feasible for us to be out and on site, which is what we hope, we would certainly do everything we could to not only keep all of our crew members safe, not only those of us on camera, but the ones behind the camera, and anyone who came out to the show. you know, that would be priority number one for us. It would certainly be different, you know, throughout the history of game day. And the post show, there are, you know, there's a lot of hand slapping and handshaking and greeting of fans afterwards. And certainly that will have to change, you know, because of the distancing guidelines and, you know, all of those types of things. It will have to change at least for the short term. And that's, you know, unfortunate, but necessary. So there will be things that would be different, but we are committed. If they play, there will be game day. What that will mean, whether that means on site, whether that means inside, you know, an empty stadium, whether that means with a partial capacity crowd or whether that means in studio, we'll still put on the same type of show that maybe with a different vibe, because you can't replicate, you know, 30,000 people in Pullman, Washington when you simply don't have that. You can't duplicate that, but we'll still put on a high level show that focuses on our passion and love for college football, and we'll cover it, cover this seemingly what promises to be a remarkable and extraordinary season in the deep history of this sport. It's going to be memorable and a landmark type season, regardless of what happens, just because of all of the things that we're going through in our country right now.
Reese, before we let you go, one thing we've also discussed this week is high school football and how high school football gets affected, and if their seasons are pushed back, or there's been a lot of different scenarios in different states of possibly moving it to February or the spring or what have you. But recruiting is a big part of that, and a lot of kids, how many times do you see in their senior season? I mean, they take huge steps, and that's the difference in a major scholarship. So what are some ways do you think that all this could affect the recruiting aspect of college football as it delays not only college football but high school football as well?
Probably the players that you mentioned, the late bloomers, the guys who really burst onto the scene as seniors, will be the ones most affected. Players are identified so early now that there are, you know, large number of players that coaches know what they will have to do then is take a little bit more of a leap of faith than they might otherwise take. And coaches have already, strictly from a football standpoint, have already complained about that. You know, you push up the signing date, which means you have less time to watch them. You have less time to watch them in their senior year to evaluate, you know, where they fit and all of those types of things. So it would be difficult. And I'm sure that for a lot of the kids who maybe either started playing football late or maybe grew physically or just got better or whatever it might be, those opportunities, there's no way around it. They would be impacted. But I don't, you know, I don't really have any tangible idea to how to mitigate that. If you can't safely play, then, you know, maybe, I mean, I know that there aren't an abundance of schools like this, but we have quite a few here in New England. Maybe a post-grad year, you know, would be something if, you know, a senior feels like he could get a better scholarship opportunity. You know, there are ways to continue to pursue the dream, yeah, and not just let go of it.
Good stuff. Reese, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll keep our fingers crossed, do all that stuff, and hope for the best here in the coming weeks and months. But thanks for your perspective, as always.
You bet. Take care. Bye-bye.
Great stuff. Reese Davis from ESPN joining us here on the show. We have had a lot of great interviews already today. We got another great one coming up on the other side of the break, as we will get a chance to talk to Tom Glavine.
Put this hat on that has an A on it. Grab that.
All right. It sounds good. Chase, I mean, that's okay. I mean, listen, I'm a Met fan. He won game number 300 as a Met, and I will never forget that. He was on some very good Mets teams that on an uptick, but he is a Brave. There's no way around it. I'm comfortable with that. I'm secure with that. No question about it. He is one of the greatest of all time. So looking forward to our conversation with him in just a moment. So let's get to it. Stay tuned. On the other side, Tom Glavine here on ESPN 102.5 The Game.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.